You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
702 and Cape Talk. Family Matters.
Right, talking family matters now. I'm setting effective boundaries, and it's such an interesting topic. We've been talking about boundaries this morning in the middle hour, talking about rape on campus, and still looking at so many SMSs just pouring through on that. Our in-studio guest today is Jeannie Cavey, clinical psychologist. Jeannie, good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I just want to pick your brain while I'm still in that mode. No is no. Setting boundaries. I just want to touch back on varsities. Your thoughts?
Okay, so last time I was on the show, the reason why we decided to talk about boundaries today, last time I was on the show, we spoke about why nice guys finish last. And something that I mentioned in the show was the research that I read recently that the number one risk factor for women for sexual assault is actually politeness. That it's politeness that puts women into situations where they get exposed to people who have bad intentions, to people who are dangerous. And it's not to say by any stretch of the imagination that we're holding the victim responsible here, but that women can take much better care of themselves and protect themselves a lot more if they're not worrying about being polite. Because it's being polite that makes us say, don't worry, okay, thank you for driving me home, instead of saying, don't worry, I'll get an Uber. Or it's politeness that says, okay, well, you can come in for a cup of coffee, or would you like to come in for a cup of coffee when we're feeling terribly uncomfortable, or even crossing to the other side of the street when somebody's making us feel uncomfortable. So it's definitely linking to what you've been talking about on the show this morning, about the importance of setting boundaries and listening to that internal voice of when and where to set boundaries sooner rather than later.
Because if you are a yes person, you fall for everything. That's the sorrowful truth.
Yes, I don't believe in the law of attraction per se, but I do believe in the power of filtering. That the way that our boundaries are set up filters certain experiences in our lives in and other experiences in our lives out. So we all get exposed and bombarded all the time with all sorts of experiences. But when your boundaries are set up effectively, you can filter some dangerous or unpleasant or even traumatic experiences out. And it's not to say all the time some people really are just caught off guard or caught by surprise or ambushed. But a lot of the time what we find, especially in universities, is that it's somebody that the person already knows in a social situation or a social situation that's gone too far. So you can go a very far way to protecting yourself if you have effectively set up boundaries. And saying no is part of that, definitely managing your capacities. But the other part of setting effective boundaries is also expressing your needs and being in touch with what your needs are in any situation.
All right, so let's start right at the beginning then. What are boundaries? Why do we need them? How do we set them up? Someone's listening, thinking, I need boundaries, but I don't know how to do this.
Yes, boundaries is something that we talk about all the time, but not very many people know exactly what boundaries are, how to describe them, because they are abstract concepts. And we can't see our interactional or our emotional boundaries. We can't describe them interactionally as if they were tangible. So we have to really look at what boundaries really, really are. And for me, the definition of boundaries is that it's the balancing point between your needs and your capacities. So what is my capacity to meet your need in this moment? That's a boundary. And also, what is your capacity to meet my need in this moment? That's also a boundary. And boundaries are what makes us visible to other people. So in our talk last time about why nice guys finish last, I said that I think that nice guys tend to finish last, or people who are typically nice tend to finish last, because they have a very difficult time setting boundaries. And it's in one of these two directions or both, either in a difficulty in managing their capacities or their difficulty in getting information or energy into the system. So if you think of boundaries almost like a budget for an economy. It manages the resources, the energy, the time, the love, the impact, all of that. It manages the resources in and the resources out to ensure the sustained survival of the system. So that's what boundaries are.
Okay. So that's what boundaries are. Mm. Boundaries in the workplace then, is that a little bit different? Because workplace is also a difficult place. You have your boss coming towards you. You have fellow colleagues coming towards you. How do you deal with them?
Okay, so I think it's not that different anyway, except in the workplace, it's not really appropriate to be talking about our boundaries emotionally. In the workplace, we have to think about things a little bit more practically. But the way that we translate our boundaries practically is also from an emotional standpoint. So although when we express our boundaries in the workplace, we won't be talking about emotions, it still comes from us reading our emotions and seeing what makes us feel comfortable, what makes us feel uncomfortable, what can we manage, what can't we manage, and what is it that we actually need. And boundaries all the time, like any kind of relationship, exists within a hierarchy anyway. And there's certain kinds of behavior that's appropriate for a certain kind of hierarchy and other behaviors that aren't appropriate for a hierarchy. But it's actually very similar to boundaries in any other area of your life.
You set these boundaries up and people don't respect them. How do you deal with those people?
How do you deal with people who don't respect your boundaries?
Yeah, actually, what do you do?
It's very swiftly is the answer. It's very swiftly. and I think it really depends. It really depends. But let's break it down a little bit more.
Sure.
And just look at boundaries from the beginning, and then we'll get to,
all right.
To get to all of those, the nitty-gritty. So a question that people have been asking me this week, talking about boundaries, and especially following on from the show last time, is how do boundaries fit in with being vulnerable? One of my favorite things to talk about, and I mention her every single time I come on the show because it's such beautiful work, is the work of Brené Brown. So Brené Brown is an American social worker, and she also works as a therapist, a wonderful speaker and writer. And she did a TED talk a few years ago about the power of vulnerability. And a lot of people, when we talk about vulnerability, say, but I can't just go around wearing my heart on my sleeve, telling everybody my story. I can't just expose myself like that. So what is vulnerability? And I think that's a misunderstanding, because there's a difference between being vulnerable and being exposed, and being vulnerable and being fragile. So I want to just break down Brené Brown's work a little bit, and then we can look at how to set boundaries effectively while still being vulnerable.
Great.
So Brené Brown did some research on a large number of people, and in that group of people, she found that some people were satisfied in their lives, some people felt happy, some people felt a sense of fulfillment, and she called those people the wholehearted. And so wholehearted people generally feel quite happy and a sense of fulfillment in their relationships. And then there's everybody else, which is a much bigger group of people. Feel isolated, feel anxious, feel depressed, feel disappointed, and feel unfulfilled. And what Brené Brown found in her work is that the only difference between the two groups was not number and quality of relationships. It wasn't socioeconomic status. It wasn't education. The only difference between these two groups was that the wholehearted believes that they are worthy of love and acceptance. That was the only difference. And everybody else has something that Brené Brown calls shame. And shame is the fear of disconnect. Shame is the idea that if you knew this one thing about me, you would disconnect from me. And so people tend to want to hide their shame. People don't want other people to see their shame, because we all fear rejection. Every human being fears rejection. It's unsafe for us to be rejected. So we hide this thing that could possibly lead to you rejecting me, and we hide it behind what we call perfection. So
right.
Perfection is the idea of what it is that you want from me. So Brené Brown's solution to all of this is vulnerability, which she defines as showing up without expectation. Okay, now all of this is also quite vague,
mm-hmm.
and it's not so tangible. And people ask me all the time, well, how do you explain that? How do you work with that in tangible terms? And my explanation is that perfection, in my view, is needlessness. If I say this garden is perfect, I'm saying it doesn't need more rose bushes, it doesn't need some fertilizer, it doesn't need more water, it doesn't need a trim, it's perfect, it doesn't need anything.
Right.
And so perfection is a needlessness that we project onto other people around us. And this needlessness actually isolates us and distances us more from everybody around us, because nobody can really get to know us. If we're not expressing our needs, if we're not setting boundaries, then we become invisible. Other people can't really see us.
Mm.
And so the expectation that I think Brené Brown is talking about, the expectation that we have to move away from, is the expectation that if you find me valuable enough, you will meet my need.
But that's tragic, though.
It is completely
tragic. That is horrible.
But everybody is afraid to ask, and everybody's afraid to say no because of the shame. If you had to really see me, if you had to really see the limits of my capacity, if you had to really hear about my silly, idiosyncratic need, you'll reject me.
Wow.
And people don't understand that people don't meet your needs when they think that you're worth it. People meet your needs when they can meet your need.
Yeah. But so, you don't see it that way.
No, we don't. We go into a greengrocer and we ask for a pair of red stilettos.
Yeah.
And then we think, okay, well, this greengrocer, if they really care about me as a customer, they will give me this pair of red stilettos. But the greengrocer doesn't have red stilettos. They've got red tomatoes. They've got red peppers.
Of course not.
So it's not from a person not wanting to give you what it is that you're asking from. It's from their lack of capacity.
Oh, I like that. Mm. I like that a lot. So Jeannie Cavett, clinical psychologist, is our guest this morning. I'd like to hear from you. Do you struggle with setting boundaries with loved ones, perhaps? Give us a call, 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567.
702 and Cape Talk. Family Matters.
Coming up to 26 minutes to midday, and talking to clinical psychologist Jeannie Cavett about setting effective boundaries. And we've been talking about relationships, setting boundaries for yourself. I think sometimes, Jeannie, it's also about just defending yourself against the world.
I think it's about managing your capacities. And I think that the thing that makes it the hardest for people to manage capacities is the emotional experience of guilt that most of the time people feel too guilty when other people express their needs to them, or when they even anticipate that there's a need, that they can't say no, they aren't allowed to say no, and over-empathize with the other person. So it might sometimes feel like we're protecting ourselves from the world, but it's actually by getting just over-indebted in commitments and over-indebted in emotional investments that you aren't getting any kind of resources into the system for. And then that actually leads me to something called what I call the guilt-resentment seesaw. So when a person gets to the point of feeling like they have to defend themselves from the world, it's usually because they've been involved in a process of a pendulum of guilt and resentment.
Yeah.
So we start off this pendulum and we feel, okay, we aren't allowed to set boundaries. We aren't allowed to say no. We aren't worthy of saying no. And we have to actually always meet the needs of everybody else around us. And so we start to over-accommodate. And it's like a pendulum ticking up and up. And as the pendulum ticks up to the one side, we build up more and more and more and more resentment. And then eventually we get to the top of the pendulum, which is completely emotionally bankrupt.
Mm.
And that's where the feeling of, okay, I have to defend myself from the world comes in. And then we snap. And then we swing all the way to the other side. And when we set a boundary, it comes with a lot of momentum behind it. So it comes with a lot of volume. And people might say something like, oh, this person is overreacting. And why are you being so overly sensitive? And then we feel guilty about setting the boundary so loudly. And so we start to over-accommodate then and swing all the way back up to the other side of the pendulum. And that's why I say about setting boundaries swiftly. Because if we set boundaries sooner rather than later, we tend to tick on the bottom end of the pendulum and have a lot more of a balanced approach to managing our needs and our capacities.
Okay, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Let's take one or two calls, 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. Ernest in Durbanville. Hi, good morning.
Hi, g'day. The thing is, I understand, but the question that I have is that, you know, this works in a relationship or in a situation where in actual fact, you know, the person is understanding of you setting your boundaries or accepting of it. In the South African context, where we've just spoken about, you know, rape at Rhodes campus. Now, the thing is, if you look at South African women, you know, you feel vulnerable just walking out of your office block down to a place to go and buy a sandwich. You know, women that, you know, getting on a train, going home, you know, opening your front door. Now, how do, as I said, this is good for coping within the context of an understanding person and a person that accepts the boundaries. But how in this context does it work for South African women to be able to cope with the vulnerability that every single woman deals with every day?
Ernest, I think that's an absolutely beautiful question and a beautiful punctuation. I think that we do need to differentiate between what we're talking about in Brené Brown's work of emotional vulnerability within a relationship and groups that are largely at risk because of inherent characteristics like their gender. So 150% you're right that South African women are definitely more at risk of sexual assault. But I think that the premise still remains the same of looking after yourself extremely well. Of course, you can't manage absolutely everything in your life and you can't keep yourself 100% protected, or else you wouldn't be able to live your life either. But I think it's about looking after yourself extremely well and being 150% aware that not everybody has got good intentions towards you. When you are an empathic person, you tend to think that everybody else is like you. You tend to think that everybody else also has good intentions towards you. So it's about keeping yourself incredibly safe by being aware that other people might not have your best interests at heart. And also to keep yourself aware of your boundaries to start with. Just this very, very, very morning, I was working with a client who is, she is successful. She is an adult woman. She is sophisticated. She is absolutely so well put together. And she was sharing a story with me from this very weekend where she had one too many drinks and she has absolutely no idea how she got home. She has absolutely no idea how she got home. And it's not to say that it's her fault because she has to protect herself from predators out there, but we do need to educate our daughters about keeping themselves safe, especially at university where the culture is of drinking, of partying, of having a good time, breaking loose from the restraints of school and parents' homes. We do need to teach our children about being aware of their internal frame of reference and when things are getting dangerous, when they're starting to lose control of themselves or when they're starting to lose control of a situation. So, Ernest, your question is...
But do you think that you know, the thing is, we do talk about a lot of different ways of doing things, but do you think that if women actually had to become a lot more aware amongst each other of expressing this vulnerability and becoming a lot more verbal, in other words, things like the ANC Women's League,
Yes,
that
I think
they are approached, that they are approached, and that the words come out very, very strongly that women are vulnerable and that things need to be done.
Yes, I definitely think so, that women are definitely at risk and that there is no shame, that there is no shame or guilt associated with being physically at risk. Women are physically not as strong as men, and women are physically at risk. But it's definitely a cultural thing that is incredibly complex, and it's very deeply run. And definitely, you know, all the women that I've ever worked with, even adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse, women who have been sexually assaulted as adults, the most damaging impact is the one of feeling responsible. So it's not for one second that I suggest that the victim is responsible, but we do need to educate women that they are allowed to look after themselves, are allowed to say no. And there's absolutely no shame in having to defend yourself. And there is absolutely no shame in not being able to defend yourself if you've been in a situation that got out of control.
Yeah.
Do you think it'll help if women in general in South Africa, you know, that they are not quiet, that they start expressing that fear more and more and more, that it, that within each other, that everyone realizes that there's a lot, that everyone is feeling the fear, and that everyone needs to actually start moving or motivating more towards it becoming a lot more active from the point of view of externalizing it instead of it all being internal as women in South Africa.
I think that's very true, but I think it also needs to start with men. If I think about my work with my clients, you know, a client was sharing with me the other day that his adult son had had an unintended consequence of a sexual relationship, and he found it quite funny. But had it, I know him well, had it been his daughter,
yeah, not so funny.
There would have not been so funny. And you know, the implication was of, oh well, you don't know where this girl has been, the girl that that he was with. You know, that she had behaved inappropriately, but so the son was behaving inappropriately also.
Yeah.
And I think it's about educating our sons as well, educating our sons about how to set effective boundaries and how to respect other people's boundaries as well. So I think, yes, that it is about women supporting women, but I think it's also about men teaching their sons.
Have we lost that? Thanks, Ernest, by the way, for your call. Thank you, Ernest. Have we lost that, though? Have we lost a sense of where we are in this country, in that we have these horrible stories coming out from Rhodes that young men are not taught boundaries?
I don't think it's that we've lost it. I think it's just we're talking about it more. It's a question of whether it's happening more, whether it's being spoken about more. For instance, you know, the idea of cancer. Are we having more cancer, or are we just getting better at diagnosing it? So I don't know. I think it is a cultural thing. I think it goes back absolutely centuries. I think it goes back in a recent study that I read, goes back to the advent of the plow.
Yeah.
Because women were always seen as equally empowered in the home. Women were always working. Women were always seen as equal partners in the home, because women were the gatherers and men were the hunters. And then with the advent of the plow, men's superior physical strength became more of an asset for gathering, and then women were redeployed to the home and became economically disempowered. And now with women returning to the workplace, not entering the workplace, it's actually an ancient tradition for women to be working. Women are getting re-empowered. So women are speaking up more about it. Women are taking their power back more. So I don't know if it's something that we've lost. I think it's something that we're aware that we need to gain.
Okay. Keep your calls coming. Okay, setting effective boundaries. We sort of started talking about that. We lost our way a little bit. Setting those effective boundaries within yourself. I also think as well, sometimes people are confident, or maybe overly confident, because it's a great form of defense.
Yes, yeah, so yes, there's a difference between confidence and self-worth. Confidence comes from knowing that you're competent, that you can achieve something, or knowing that you're right. So a lot of the time, people want to be confident about setting boundaries. So they wait for knowing when they are right and when they're justified. And so when they do set their boundaries, it comes with a big explanation of the reason why they are setting this boundary, or why they are saying no, or why they're expressing the need. And then that opens up what I call a court case. So when we come with a rational explanation for our boundary, we end up opening up a court case, an objective discussion about where this boundary should be, as if this boundary was an organism that has different needs and different capacities, and that you can just simply set your boundaries with a subjective expression of a motivation for this boundary. So for instance, instead of saying, you know, I think you need to be at work on time, because, you know, I'm paying you per hour, and the person then could turn around and say, well, I'm often working overtime, so where's my pay for that? We can just say, it would make me feel so relieved if you were at work on time tomorrow.
I'm going to try that. Let's go to Reg in Parkview. Hi, good morning, Reg.
Hi, Ray.
Hi, go for it.
I, We've got a 6-year-old daughter, and I'd like to know, how do I teach her boundaries without making her a fearful person? Because she's an extremely loving little girl, loves giving hugs, loves just caring for people.
Oh, what a beautiful question.
She's really exposed in my mind, because I understand the world. She doesn't understand it, you know, as well as I do. She will kind of just, you know, just love everybody that comes along. She has almost everybody that she comes across, you know.
Oh, it's such a beautiful question. And I think that your daughter already has an advantage, that she's got a father who is teaching her to love herself and that she's worth something. So I think that's already half the battle won. That's absolutely beautiful to hear from you, Reg. And I think that it comes even down to simple things. So the answer here for me is about being very much in touch with what makes you comfortable.
Okay.
It's about being in touch with what your internal frame of reference is. So even things like making your children eat when they're not hungry, or making them eat things that they don't like. Some children actually lack the enzyme in their mouth to be able to break down something in broccoli and spinach, which makes it incredibly bitter for them.
Oh, that's the truth behind it then. Okay,
yes.
All right.
So we force them to eat something that's like, for us, like eating soap. And then we think they're being difficult, so they're being obstinate. But a lot of the time, it's just about teaching your children to be very much in touch with their own needs. So teaching your daughter about her internal frame of reference. Okay, when is she hungry? Who does she feel comfortable being with? And teaching her that discomfort, that uncomfortable feeling, that sense of disequilibrium in her body is her body's way of telling her that something isn't right, and that she is entitled to say no. She is entitled to be rude. She doesn't always have to be nice. I have a beautiful client that I work with, and she had a difficult time setting boundaries in emotional relationships, because when she was a little girl and a boy had a crush on her mother would always tell her, "Ach, be nice. Be nice to him."
There's a problem there.
Yes. Oh, be nice. He's very sweet. He just likes you. Be nice. And so she gets into these relationships with guys that don't treat her very nicely, and thinks, well, I've got to be nice, and I can't say no, and I can't put my own needs forward. So it's about teaching your daughter that she is 100% entitled to her feelings. There's nothing as a person that's too sensitive. And here my absolutely favorite story to tell children is the story of the princess and the pea. I don't know if people are familiar with it.
Go for it.
So in the story of the princess and the pea, I'll just shorten it because I love telling stories so I can go on and on. In the story of the princess and the pea, there was a handsome prince who was just wonderful in every way. And when he wanted to get married, his mother sent out an invitation to all the ladies in all the lands that they could come and meet the prince. And if he hits it off with one of them, like a fairy tale Tinder, I suppose, if he hits it off with one of them, they could potentially get married. But she knew that only a true princess would be good enough for her son, who was absolutely wonderful in every way, like mine. And so she designed a screening measure, and she put a stack of 1,000 mattresses out for each girl to sleep on one by one. And underneath the stack of 1,000 mattresses, she put a single pea.
Right.
And so the ladies would come and they'd want to meet the prince, and she'd invite them for the night, and they would sleep on the mattress, on the stack of 1,000 mattresses. And in the morning, she'd say to them, "Oh, my dear, how did you sleep?" And each lady would say, "Your Majesty, I slept wonderfully. Those mattresses were so comfortable." And then she knew this was not a true princess.
Sure.
Until, of course, one girl came along, and she spent the night on the mattresses. And in the morning, the queen said to her, "Oh, my darling, how did you sleep?" And she said, "Your Majesty, I'm afraid I'm very tired. I didn't sleep very well." And the queen said, "How come?" And she said, "Well, I'm afraid those mattresses were very lumpy." And the queen knew that only a true princess would be sensitive enough to feel the pee under the stack of 1,000 mattresses. Now, why do I love that story so much? First of all, it shows us that being sensitive is actually an asset. That we always say to people, "Oh, don't be so sensitive. You're not being too sensitive. It's an asset. To be aware of your surroundings, to be aware of your internal frame of reference is an asset." Secondly, we're also showing that you've got to speak up. Had that girl been polite and said to the queen, "Thank you, Your Majesty, I slept wonderfully," she never would have got a chance to meet the prince. And of course, they lived happily ever after. I can't believe I left that part out.
Yeah, you have to put that part in.
Yes.
There we go.
Yes. And then thirdly, I love it because at the end of the day, she still had a bad night's sleep. So setting boundaries, being aware of yourself, being aware of your surroundings, your internal frame of reference, your needs and your capacities, it is uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable, but it's completely worth it at the end of the day. So, Reg, if you teach your daughter to listen to herself, listen to her needs, and that she is allowed to express them, she doesn't always have to be a nice little girl. You're going so far in teaching her how to keep herself safe without making her feel frightened of her surroundings.
But then I have to ask you then, and at least it sort of goes into abusive relationships. Why do people then stay in abusive relationships? They know they're being abused. It's happening time and time again. Mm. is it a case that those boundaries have just been beaten down and you can't build them again? What goes on there?
That's a beautiful question. Also one of my favorite subjects, and I work with so many people, men and women, who are wonderful people, who are attractive, intelligent, successful, and who are in abusive relationships. And it's a complex issue, but I'd like to explain it as follows. First of all, we must understand that it doesn't happen overnight. It's very insidious. I read a study of a psychologist who works with a group of men who are court ordered to be in a rehabilitation because they're abusers. And she asked them, how long should you wait before you start abusing your partner? And they all agreed that you can't do it right away. You first have to make her dependent on you. You first have to isolate her from her supports, or else she'll just leave you.
Yeah.
And they couldn't agree on a time, but some of them said up to 2 years, that you treat her well for up to 2 years and then you start small. So we must remember that it's very insidious. So there's really an investment that the person has with somebody who's abusive. Now, secondly, when someone abuses you, it's humiliating. And something that's humiliating takes a little piece of your self-worth. So that person takes this piece of your self-worth and then they're holding it in the palm of their hand, almost like a piece of your puzzle. Now, your choices are either to walk away without that piece of your puzzle or to try and get that piece back. And then they come close, and the only way to get that piece back is to come close and try win the approval of the person who's abused them.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
And so then they come close enough, and then the person takes another piece.
Mm.
And then just when the person thinks, you know what, I'm going to walk away without these 10 pieces of my puzzle, the abuser gives you that piece back.
Oh, just to keep you on the string.
Just to keep you there. And it feels so wonderful. Some of my clients have told me that the best taste in the whole world is the cup of tea that her husband brings her after he's beaten her.
What?
So, yeah, so it's an incredibly, I think that leaving an abusive relationship is the most remarkable thing a human being can do. It's not easy at all. And I've got so much respect for somebody who manages to do it because it's incredibly difficult. Because it's like leaving a job when you're bankrupt. It's very difficult to leave a job when you're bankrupt and you don't have another job offer on the table. So it takes so much courage, so much resilience. And I've got a mountain of respect for people who manage to do it because it's an incredibly complex, even addictive pattern in a relationship where you get hooked on the relief from winning a little piece of your puzzle back.
But then how do you build up that resistance? How do you build up that self-worth? How do you get somebody out of that relationship to realize that cup of tea is just rubbish?
So I think that it's about making sure that you never become isolated. So one of the MOs of abusive relationships is that one of isolation. And to also be aware of your self-worth, which is an incredibly complex thing and difficult thing to become aware of. Confidence is more of a conscious process. I'm aware of my skills and my attributes. So some people can be incredibly confident but have absolutely zero self-worth. So it comes from actually how we're looking after our children and the messages we're sending our children where their subconscious views of themselves are developing. But later in life of getting out of abusive relationships and supporting people who are in abusive relationships is to remember never to polarize. Never tell the person that, you know, you're absolutely stupid if you go back to him and don't go back to him. But to make sure that they've always got an out, that they can always talk to you and you will never judge and you will never criticize and that you will also always only understand.
But is that a type of personality though? Because you find very often as well, my parents were abusive, then I go on and I become abusive and history just repeats itself. Is it genetic? Is it personality? How does that work?
Well, it's a good question of nature versus nurture, which is, I think, the oldest question in psychology that there is. there was an Egyptian king who was the first to do any kind of psychological experiment, and his experiment was to see whether speech was innate or whether it was learned, because of course they only had one language in their culture. And so he isolated 5 babies in his castle, and each one had a nurse and they were well taken care of, but the nurses were instructed never to talk to them. And in the book it says kind of tongue-in-cheek that the experiment couldn't be concluded because all the babies died.
Okay.
So it's about it's nature and nurture, but it's about communication, it's about relationship, and it's about making sure that you never become isolated in any kind of relationship. Mm. So some people do have a tendency to become more codependent than other people, either through their upbringing or genetically or even socially, but it's about making sure that you always have something of your own social frame of reference and other relationships so that you never become isolated into any one particular thing.
Yeah, you survive on your own. Mm. Let's go to Rabbi Nielsen. Hi, Rabbi. Good morning. Welcome.
Hi, how's it?
Hi, go for it. You're on the air.
I just heard you guys talking about boundaries earlier and setting your boundaries. I just remember learning in the Jewish law when I was studying, one of the most fascinating pieces of interpersonal relationships, at least between the genders, was this law, the halacha of yichud. And this law basically states that a man and a woman who are basically not, immediate family, who have the potential of being in a relationship, should never ever be alone in a room together, just them two. And, you know, I think that especially in this age of like the Me Too movement, where abusive, you know, sexual encounters are becoming more and more rampant or maybe known, this simple law has the ability to just stop that from the get-go with the setting of boundaries, like the doctor was talking about.
Right. Okay. All right, Rabbi. I just want to put you on hold there. We have to let you go and push for time. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that in theory and also in a different time and place, yes, that could have definitely been quite valuable. And also in terms of smaller communities. I myself studied Judaism. I was married to a lovely man who was himself Jewish. So I've studied Judaism, so I understand it, not obviously as well as the rabbi. And I think that it can definitely have a place. But we also have to remember that sometimes it's, you know, a brother and a sister.
Sure.
Sometimes it's a father and a daughter. So I think that it's like sometimes saying, you know, if you bend your arm, you say, doctor, it hurts when I do this. And the doctor says, okay, well then don't do that. That we can definitely do a lot on this level of symptom, but we also have to go a lot to the level of mechanism, of the underlying mechanism.
Yeah.
So yes, we can definitely help people with rigid boundaries to protect themselves. But I think that the real solution here is not on the level of symptom about leaving a boy and a girl alone in a room or a man and a woman alone in a room, but about a fundamental respect between the genders, a fundamental respect between people actually, that you are entitled, with respect for yourself, that you are entitled to set boundaries. A lot of the times, and I'm not saying it's every time, but a lot of the times women will cooperate, not consent, but cooperate out of fear, out of fear of physical injury,
yeah,
or out of fear of rejection or embarrassment, will tolerate, is a better word, will tolerate something that makes them feel incredibly uncomfortable and they later feel guilty. So I think it's more about the underlying mechanisms of why this is happening in our culture rather than about the symptomatic prevention.
How to deal with, just how to stop it. Let's, all right, time for one more call. Manu, hi, good morning. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, go for it.
You know, Ray, I couldn't agree more with the psychologist with regards to setting boundaries.
Thank you.
I was married at the age of 18 and never heard of setting boundaries. I'm now 63 years old. I grew up in an era where you stayed. Whatever the circumstances where you stayed or else, I'm of Indian descent and it would be regarded as disgraceful to walk away. It would be regarded as an embarrassment to the family. And so I stayed. I stayed for 10 years because I didn't even have a matric certificate. I was 18 years old when I was married. I then decided to go back and study to empower myself.
Mm.
And through that, I learned how to set boundaries. And I eventually walked away despite all the threats.
Sure.
If you leave, I'll kill you. If you leave, I'll do this. If you leave, I won't support you. And he did. He kept to his word. And but you know what? I raised my kids on my own. By the age of 28, I divorced him. And
Sure, Manu. We kind of get the gist of what you're saying. And I absolutely applaud you. I really, really do. You're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. But another example of somebody who maybe found their boundaries and grew.
Yeah, I've got so much respect for Manu and what she shared. And I think the two things I just want to highlight there was what she said in the beginning that nobody ever taught her. So we need to teach our children, both boys and girls. And secondly, that she empowered herself. So making sure that our children are empowered. Yeah. And